This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism, and Progress by Steven Pinker. Read for you by Arthur Morey. Those who are governed by reason desire nothing for themselves which they do not also desire for the rest of humankind. Baruch Spinoza. Everything that is not forbidden by laws of nature is achievable, given the right knowledge. David Deutsch. Preface. The second half of the second decade of the third millennium would not seem to be an auspicious time to publish a book on the historical sweep of progress and its causes. At the time of this writing, my country is led by people with a dark vision of the current moment. Mothers and children trapped in poverty, an education system which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge, and the crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives. We are in an outright war that is expanding and metastasizing. The blame for this nightmare may be placed on a global power structure that has eroded the underlying spiritual and moral foundations of Christianity. In this audiobook, I will show that this bleak assessment of the state of the world is wrong. And not just a little wrong. Wrong, wrong. Flat Earth wrong. Couldn't be more wrong. But this book is not about the 45th President of the United States and his advisors. It was conceived some years before Donald Trump announced his candidacy, and I hope it will outlast his administration by many more. The ideas that prepared the ground for his election are in fact widely shared among intellectuals and lay people on both the left and the right. They include pessimism about the way the world is heading, cynicism about the institutions of modernity, and an inability to conceive of a higher purpose in anything other than religion. I will present a different understanding of the world, grounded in fact and inspired by the ideals of the Enlightenment, reason, science, humanism, and progress. Enlightenment ideals, I hope to show, are timeless, but they have never been more relevant than they are right now. Part 1. Enlightenment. The common sense of the 18th century, its grasp of the obvious facts of human suffering, and of the obvious demands of human nature, acted on the world like a bath of moral cleansing. Alfred North Whitehead. In the course of several decades giving public lectures on language, mind, and human nature, I have been asked some mighty strange questions. Which is the best language? Are clams and oysters conscious? When will I be able to upload my mind to the internet? Is obesity a form of violence? But the most arresting question I have ever fielded followed a talk in which I explained the commonplace among scientists that mental life consists of patterns of activity in the tissues of the brain. A student in the audience raised her hand and asked me, "Why should I live?" The student's ingenuous tone made it clear that she was neither suicidal nor sarcastic, but genuinely curious about how to find meaning and purpose if traditional religious beliefs about an immortal soul are undermined by our best science. My policy is that there is no such thing as a stupid question, and to the surprise of the student, the audience, and most of all myself, I mustered a reasonably creditable answer. What I recall saying, embellished to be sure by the distortions of memory and l'esprit de l'escalier, the wit of the staircase, went something like this. In the very act of asking that question, you are seeking reasons for your convictions, and so you are committed to reason as the means to discover and justify what is important to you, and there are so many reasons to live. As a sentient being, you have the potential to flourish. You can refine your faculty of reason itself by learning and debating. You can seek explanations of the natural world through science and insight into the human condition through the arts and humanities. you can make the most of your capacity for pleasure and satisfaction, which allowed your ancestors to thrive and thereby allowed you to exist. You can appreciate the beauty and richness of the natural and cultural world. As the heir to billions of years of life perpetuating itself, you can perpetuate life in turn. You have been endowed with a sense of sympathy, the ability to like, love, respect, help, and show kindness, and you can enjoy the gift of mutual benevolence with friends, family, and colleagues. And because reason tells you that none of this is particular to you, you have the responsibility to provide to others what you expect for yourself. You can foster the welfare of other sentient beings by enhancing life, health, knowledge, freedom, abundance, safety, beauty, and peace. History shows that when we sympathize with others and apply our ingenuity to improving the human condition, we can make progress in doing so, and you can help to continue that progress. Explaining the meaning of life is not in the usual job description of a professor of cognitive science, and I would not have had the gall to take up her question if the answer depended on my arcane technical knowledge or my dubious personal wisdom. But I knew I was channeling a body of beliefs and values that had taken shape more than two centuries before me, and that are now more relevant than ever, the ideals of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment principle that we can apply reason and sympathy to enhance human flourishing may seem obvious, trite, old-fashioned. I wrote this book because I've come to realize that it is not. More than ever, the ideals of science, reason, humanism, and progress need a wholehearted defense. We take its gifts for granted. Newborns who will live more than 8 decades, markets overflowing with food, clean water that appears with a flick of a finger, and waste that disappears with another. Pills that erase a painful infection. Sons who are not sent off to war. Daughters who can walk the streets in safety. Critics of the powerful who are not jailed or shot. The world's knowledge and culture available in a shirt pocket. But these are human accomplishments, not cosmic birthrights. In the memories of many listeners to this audiobook, and in the experience of those in less fortunate parts of the world, war, scarcity, disease, ignorance, and lethal menace are a natural part of existence. We know that countries can slide back into these primitive conditions, and so we ignore the achievements of the Enlightenment at our peril. In the years since I took the young woman's question, I have often been reminded of the need to restate the ideals of the Enlightenment, also called humanism, the open society, and cosmopolitan or classical liberalism. It's not just that questions like hers regularly appear in my inbox. Dear Professor Pinker, what advice do you have for someone who has taken ideas in your books and science to heart and sees himself as a collection of atoms? A machine with a limited scope of intelligence sprung out of selfish genes inhabiting space-time. It's also that an obliviousness to the scope of human progress can lead to symptoms that are worse than existential angst. It can make people cynical about the Enlightenment-inspired institutions that are securing this progress, such as liberal democracy and organizations of international cooperation, and turn them toward atavistic alternatives. The ideals of the Enlightenment are products of human reason, but they always struggle with other strands of human nature, loyalty to tribe, deference to authority, magical thinking, the blaming of misfortune on evildoers. The second decade of the 21st century has seen the rise of political movements that depict their countries as being pulled into a hellish dystopia by malign factions that can be resisted only by a strong leader who wrenches the country backward to make it great again. These movements have been abetted by a narrative shared by many of their fiercest opponents, in which the institutions of modernity have failed, and every aspect of life is in deepening crisis. The two sides in macabre agreement that wrecking those institutions will make the world a better place. Harder to find is a positive vision that sees the world's problems against a background of progress that it seeks to build upon by solving those problems in their turn. If you still are unsure whether the ideals of Enlightenment humanism need a vigorous defense, consider the diagnosis of Shiraz Meyer, an analyst of radical Islamist movements. The West is shy of its values. It doesn't speak up for classical liberalism, he says. We are unsure of them. They make us feel uneasy. Contrast that with the Islamic State, which knows exactly what it stands for, a certainty that is incredibly seductive. And he should know, having once been a regional director of the jihadist group Hizb ut-Tahrir. Reflecting on liberal ideals in 1960, not long after they had withstood their greatest trial, the economist Friedrich Hayek observed, "If old truths are to retain their hold on men's minds, they must be restated in the language and concepts of successive generations," inadvertently proving his point with the expression, "men's minds." What at one time are their most effective expressions gradually become so worn with use that they cease to carry a definite meaning. The underlying ideas may be as valid as ever, but the words, even when they refer to problems that are still with us, no longer convey the same conviction. This book is my attempt to restate the ideals of the Enlightenment and the language and concepts of the 21st century. I will first lay out a framework for understanding the human condition informed by modern science, who we are, where we came from, what our challenges are, and how we can meet them. The bulk of this book is devoted to defending those ideals in a distinctively 21st century way, with data. This evidence-based take on the Enlightenment project reveals that it was not a naive hope. The Enlightenment has worked, perhaps the greatest story seldom told. And because this triumph is so unsung, the underlying ideals of reason, science, and humanism are unappreciated as well. Far from being an insipid consensus, these ideals are treated by today's intellectuals with indifference, skepticism, and sometimes contempt. When properly appreciated, I will suggest, the ideals of the Enlightenment are in fact stirring, inspiring, noble. A reason to live. Chapter 1. Dare to Understand. What is enlightenment? In a 1784 essay with that question as its title, Immanuel Kant answered that it consists of humankind's emergence from its self-incurred immaturity, its lazy and cowardly submission to the dogmas and formulas of religious or political authority. Enlightenment's motto, he proclaimed, is "Dare to Understand." And its foundational demand is freedom of thought and speech. One age cannot conclude a pact that would prevent succeeding ages from extending their insights, increasing their knowledge, and purging their errors. That would be a crime against human nature, whose proper destiny lies precisely in such progress. A 21st century statement of the same idea may be found in the physicist David Deutsch's defense of enlightenment, The Beginning of Infinity. Deutsch argues that if we dare to understand, progress is possible in all fields, scientific, political, and moral. Optimism, in the sense that I have advocated, is the theory that all failures, all evils, are due to insufficient knowledge. Problems are inevitable because our knowledge will always be infinitely far from complete. Some problems are hard, but it is a mistake to confuse hard problems with problems unlikely to be solved. Problems are soluble, and each particular evil is a problem that can be solved. An optimistic civilization is open and not afraid to innovate, and is based on traditions of criticism. Its institutions keep improving, and the most important knowledge that they embody is knowledge of how to detect and eliminate errors. What is the Enlightenment? There is no official answer because the era named by Kant's essay was never demarcated by opening and closing ceremonies like the Olympics, nor are its tenets stipulated in an oath or creed. The Enlightenment is conventionally placed in the last two-thirds of the 18th century. Though it flowed out of the Scientific Revolution and the Age of Reason in the 17th century and spilled into the heyday of classical liberalism in the first half of the 19th. Provoked by challenges to conventional wisdom from science and exploration, mindful of the bloodshed of recent wars of religion, and abetted by the easy movement of ideas and people, the thinkers of the Enlightenment sought a new understanding of the human condition. The era was a cornucopia of ideas, some of them contradictory, but four themes tie them together: reason, science, humanism, and progress. Foremost is reason. Reason is non-negotiable. As soon as you show up to discuss the question of what we should live for, or any other question, as long as you insist that your answers, whatever they are reasonable or justified or true, and that therefore other people ought to believe them too, then you have committed yourself to reason, and to holding your beliefs accountable to objective standards. If there's anything the Enlightenment thinkers had in common, it was an insistence that we energetically apply the standard of reason to understanding our world, and not fall back on generators of delusion like faith, dogma, revelation, authority, charisma, mysticism, divination, visions, gut feelings, or the hermeneutic parsing of sacred texts. It was reason that led most of the Enlightenment thinkers to repudiate a belief in an anthropomorphic God who took an interest in human affairs. The application of reason revealed that reports of miracles were dubious, that the authors of holy books were all too human, that natural events unfolded with no regard to human welfare, and that different cultures believed in mutually incompatible deities, none of them less likely than the others to be products of the imagination. As Montesquieu wrote, "If triangles had a god, they would give him three sides." For all that, not all of the Enlightenment thinkers were atheists. Some were deists, as opposed to theists. They thought that God set the universe in motion and then stepped back, allowing it to unfold according to the laws of nature. Others were pantheists, who used God as a synonym for the laws of nature. But few appealed to the law-giving, miracle-conjuring, son-begetting God of Scripture. Many writers today confuse the Enlightenment endorsement of reason with the implausible claim that humans are perfectly rational agents. Nothing could be further from historical reality. Thinkers such as Kant, Baruch Spinoza, Thomas Hobbes, David Hume, and Adam Smith were inquisitive psychologists and all too aware of our irrational passions and foibles. They insisted that it was only by calling out the common sources of folly that we could hope to overcome them. The deliberate application of reason was necessary precisely because our common habits of thought are not particularly reasonable. That leads to the second ideal, science, the refining of reason to understand the world. The scientific revolution was revolutionary in a way that is hard to appreciate today, now that its discoveries have become second nature to most of us. The historian David Wooden reminds us of the understanding of an educated Englishman on the eve of the revolution in 1600. He believes witches can summon up storms that sink ships at sea. He believes in werewolves, although there happen not to be any in England. He knows they are to be found in Belgium. He believes Circe really did turn Odysseus's crew into pigs. He believes mice are spontaneously generated in piles of straw. He believes in contemporary magicians. He has seen a unicorn's horn, but not a unicorn. He believes that a murdered body will bleed in the presence of the murderer. He believes that there is an ointment which, if rubbed on a dagger which has caused a wound, will cure the wound. He believes that the shape, color, and texture of a plant can be a clue to how it will work as a medicine, because God designed nature to be interpreted by mankind. He believes that it is possible to turn base metal into gold, although he doubts that anyone knows how to do it. He believes that nature abhors a vacuum. He believes the rainbow is a sign from God and that comets portend evil. He believes that dreams predict the future, if we know how to interpret them. He believes, of course, that the earth stands still, and the sun and stars turn around the earth once every 24 hours. A century and a third later, an educated descendant of this Englishman would believe none of these things. It was an escape not just from ignorance, but from terror. The sociologist Robert Scott notes that in the Middle Ages, the belief that an external force controlled daily life contributed to a kind of collective paranoia. Rainstorms, thunder, lightning, wind gusts, solar or lunar eclipses, cold snaps, heat waves, dry spells, and earthquakes alike were considered signs and signals of God's displeasure. As a result, the hobgoblins of fear inhabited every realm of life. The sea became a satanic realm, and forests were populated with beasts of prey, ogres, witches, demons, and very real thieves and cutthroats. After dark, too, the world was filled with omens portending dangers of every sort: comets, meteors, shooting stars, lunar eclipses, the howls of wild animals. To the Enlightenment thinkers, the escape from ignorance and superstition showed how mistaken our conventional wisdom could be, and how the methods of science, skepticism, fallibilism, open debate, and empirical testing are a paradigm of how to achieve reliable knowledge. That knowledge includes an understanding of ourselves. The need for a science of man was a theme that tied together Enlightenment thinkers who disagreed about much else, including Montesquieu, Hume, Smith, Kant, Nicolas de Condorcet, Denis Diderot, Jean-Baptiste d'Alembert, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Giambattista Vico. Their belief that there was such a thing as universal human nature, and that it could be studied scientifically, made them precocious practitioners of sciences that would be named only centuries later. They were cognitive neuroscientists who tried to explain thought, emotion, and psychopathology in terms of physical mechanisms of the brain. They were evolutionary psychologists who sought to characterize life in a state of nature and to identify the animal instincts that are infused into our bosoms. They were social psychologists who wrote of the moral sentiments that draw us together, the selfish passions that divide us, and the foibles of short-sightedness that confound our best-laid plans. And they were cultural anthropologists who mined the accounts of travelers and explorers for data both on human universals and on the diversity of customs and mores across the world's cultures. The idea of a universal human nature brings us to a third theme, humanism. The thinkers of the Age of Reason and the Enlightenment saw an urgent need for a secular foundation for morality, because they were haunted by a historical memory of centuries of religious carnage: the Crusades, the Inquisition, witch hunts, the European wars of religion. They laid that foundation in what we now call humanism, which privileges the well-being of individual men, women, and children over the glory of the tribe, race, nation, or religion. It is individuals, not groups, who are sentient, who feel pleasure and pain, fulfillment and anguish. Whether it is framed as the goal of providing the greatest happiness for the greatest number, or as a categorical imperative to treat people as ends rather than means, it was the universal capacity of a person to suffer and flourish, they said, that called on our moral concern. Fortunately, human nature prepares us to answer that call. That is because we are endowed with the sentiment of sympathy, which they also called benevolence, pity, and commiseration. Given that we are equipped with the capacity to sympathize with others, nothing can prevent the circle of sympathy from expanding from the family and tribe to embrace all of humankind, particularly as reason goads us into realizing that there can be nothing uniquely deserving about ourselves or any of the groups to which we belong. we are forced into cosmopolitanism, accepting our citizenship in the world. A humanistic sensibility impelled the Enlightenment thinkers to condemn not just religious violence, but also the secular cruelties of their age, including slavery, despotism, executions for frivolous offenses such as shoplifting and poaching, and sadistic punishments such as flogging, amputation, impalement, disembowelment, breaking on the wheel, and burning at the stake. The Enlightenment is sometimes called the humanitarian revolution, because it led to the abolition of barbaric practices that had been commonplace across civilizations for millennia. If the abolition of slavery and cruel punishment is not progress, nothing is. Which brings us to the fourth Enlightenment ideal. With our understanding of the world advanced by science and our circle of sympathy expanded through reason and cosmopolitanism, humanity could make intellectual and moral progress. It need not resign itself to the miseries and irrationalities of the present, nor try to turn back the clock to a lost golden age. The Enlightenment belief in progress should not be confused with the 19th century romantic belief in mystical forces, laws, dialectics, struggles, unfoldings, destinies, ages of man, and evolutionary forces that propel mankind ever upward toward utopia. As Kant's remark about increasing knowledge and purging errors indicates, it was more prosaic, a combination of reason and humanism. If we keep track of how our laws and manners are doing, think up ways to improve them, try them out, and keep the ones that make people better off, we can gradually make the world a better place. Science itself creeps forward through this cycle of theory and experiment, and its ceaseless headway, superimposed on local setbacks and reversals, shows how progress is possible. The ideal of progress also should not be confused with the 20th century movement to re-engineer society for the convenience of technocrats and planners, which the political scientist James Scott calls authoritarian high modernism. The movement denied the existence of human nature with its messy needs for beauty, nature, tradition, and social intimacy. Starting from a clean tablecloth, the modernists designed urban renewal projects that replaced vibrant neighborhoods with freeways, high-rises, windswept plazas, and brutalist architecture. Mankind will be reborn, they theorized, and live in an ordered relationship to the whole. Though these developments were sometimes linked to the word progress, the usage was ironic. Progress, unguided by humanism, is not progress. Rather than trying to shape human nature, the Enlightenment hope for progress was concentrated on human institutions. Human-made systems, like governments, laws, schools, markets, and international bodies, are a natural target for the application of reason to human betterment. In this way of thinking, government is not a divine fiat to reign, a synonym for society or an avatar of the national, religious, or racial soul. It is a human invention, tacitly agreed to in a social contract designed to enhance the welfare of citizens by coordinating their behavior and discouraging selfish acts that may be tempting to every individual but leave everyone worse off. As the most famous product of the Enlightenment, the Declaration of Independence, put it, "In order to secure the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, governments are instituted among people, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Among the powers of government is meting out punishment, and writers such as Montesquieu, Cesare Beccaria, and the American founders thought afresh about the government's license to harm its citizens. Criminal punishment, they argued, is not a mandate to implement cosmic justice, but part of an incentive structure that discourages antisocial acts without causing more suffering than it deters. The reason the punishment should fit the crime, for example, is not to balance some mystical scale of justice, but to ensure that a wrongdoer stops at a minor crime rather than escalating to a more harmful one. Cruel punishments, whether or not they are in some sense deserved, are no more effective at deterring harm than moderate but surer punishments, and they desensitize spectators and brutalize the society that implements them. The Enlightenment also saw the first rational analysis of prosperity. Its starting point was not how wealth is distributed, but the prior question of how wealth comes to exist in the first place. Smith, building on French, Dutch, and Scottish influences, noted that an abundance of useful stuff cannot be conjured into existence by a farmer or craftsman working in isolation. It depends on a network of specialists, each of whom learns how to make something as efficiently as possible, and who combine and exchange the fruits of their ingenuity, skill, and labor. In a famous example, Smith calculated that a pin maker working alone could make at most one pin a day, whereas in a workshop in which one man draws out the wire, another straights it, a third cuts it, a fourth points it, a fifth grinds it at the top for receiving the head, each could make almost 5,000. Specialization works only in a market that allows the specialists to exchange their goods and services, and Smith explained that economic activity was a form of mutually beneficial cooperation, a positive-sum game, in today's lingo. Each gets back something that is more valuable to him than what he gives up. Through voluntary exchange, people benefit others by benefiting themselves. As he wrote, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love." Smith was not saying that people are ruthlessly selfish, or that they ought to be. He was one of history's keenest commentators on human sympathy. He only said that in a market, whatever tendency people have to care for their families and themselves can work to the good of all. Exchange can make an entire society not just richer, but nicer, because in an effective market it is cheaper to buy things than to steal them, and other people are more valuable to you alive than dead. As the economist Ludwig von Mises put it centuries later, "If the tailor goes to war against the baker, he must henceforth bake his own bread." Many Enlightenment thinkers, including Montesquieu, Kant, Voltaire, Diderot, and the Abbé de Saint-Pierre, endorsed the ideal of doux commerce, gentle commerce. The American founders, George Washington, James Madison, and especially Alexander Hamilton, designed the institutions of the young nation to nurture it. This brings us to another Enlightenment ideal, peace. War was so common in history that it was natural to see it as a permanent part of the human condition, and to think peace could come only in a messianic age. But now war was no longer thought of as a divine punishment to be endured and deplored, or a glorious contest to be won and celebrated, but a practical problem to be mitigated and someday solved. In Perpetual Peace, Kant laid out measures that would discourage leaders from dragging their countries into war. Together with international commerce, he recommended representative republics, what we would call democracies, mutual transparency, norms against conquest and internal interference, freedom of travel and immigration, and a federation of states that would adjudicate disputes between them. For all the prescience of the founders, framers, and philosophes, this is not a book of Enlightenolatry. The Enlightenment thinkers were men and women of their age, the 18th century. Some were racists, sexists, anti-Semites, slaveholders, or dualists. Some of the questions they worried about are almost incomprehensible to us, and they came up with plenty of daffy ideas together with the brilliant ones. More to the point, they were born too soon to appreciate some of the keystones of our modern understanding of reality. They, of all people, would have been the first to concede this. If you extol reason, then what matters is the integrity of the thoughts, not the personalities of the thinkers. And if you're committed to progress, you can't very well claim to have it all figured out. It takes nothing away from the Enlightenment thinkers to identify some critical ideas about the human condition and the nature of progress that we know and they didn't. Those ideas, I suggest, are entropy, evolution, and information. Chapter 2. Entro, Evo, Info. The first keystone in understanding the human condition is the concept of entropy, or disorder, which emerged from 19th century physics and was defined in its current form by the physicist Ludwig Boltzmann. The second law of thermodynamics states that in an isolated system, one that is not interacting with its environment, entropy never decreases. The first law is that energy is conserved. The third, that a temperature of absolute zero is unreachable. Closed systems inexorably become less structured, less organized, less able to accomplish interesting and useful outcomes until they slide into an equilibrium of gray, tepid, homogeneous monotony, and stay there. In its original formulation, the second law referred to the process in which usable energy in the form of a difference in temperature between two bodies is inevitably dissipated as heat flows from the warmer to the cooler body. As the musical team Flanders and Swann explained, you can't pass heat from the cooler to the hotter. Try it if you like, but you far better notter. A cup of coffee, unless it is placed on a plugged-in hot plate, will cool down. When the coal feeding a steam engine is used up, the cooled-off steam on one side of the piston can no longer budge it because the warmed-up steam and air on the other side are pushing back just as hard. Once it was appreciated that heat is not an invisible fluid but the energy in moving molecules, and that a difference in temperature between two bodies consists of a difference in the average speeds of those molecules, a more general statistical version of the concept of entropy and the second law took shape. Now order could be characterized in terms of the set of all microscopically distinct states of a system. In the original example involving heat, the possible speeds and positions of all the molecules in the two bodies. Of all these states, the ones that we find useful from a bird's-eye view, such as one body being hotter than the other, which translates into the average speed of the molecules in one body being higher than the average speed in the other, make up a tiny fraction of the possibilities, while all the disorderly or useless states, the ones without a temperature difference, in which the average speeds in the two bodies are the same, make up the vast majority. It follows that any perturbation of the system, whether it is a random jiggling of its parts or a whack from the outside, will, by the laws of probability, nudge the system toward disorder or uselessness, not because nature strives for disorder, but because there are so many more ways of being disorderly than of being orderly. If you walk away from a sandcastle, it won't be there tomorrow, because as the wind, waves, seagulls, and small children push the grains of sand around, they're more likely to arrange them into one of the vast numbers of configurations that don't look like a castle than into the tiny few that do. I'll often refer to the statistical version of the second law, which does not apply specifically to temperature differences evening out, but to order dissipating, as the law of entropy. How is entropy relevant to human affairs? Life and happiness depend on an infinitesimal sliver of orderly arrangements of matter amid the astronomical number of possibilities. Our bodies are improbable assemblies of molecules, and they maintain that order with the help of other improbabilities, the few substances that can nourish us, the few materials in the few shapes that can clothe us, shelter us, and move things around to our liking. Far more of the arrangements of matter found on Earth are of no worldly use to us, so when things change without a human agent directing the change, they are likely to change for the worse. The law of entropy is widely acknowledged in everyday life in sayings such as, things fall apart, rust never sleeps, shit happens, whatever can go wrong will go wrong, and, from the Texas lawmaker Sam Rayburn, any jackass can kick down a barn, but it takes a carpenter to build one. Scientists appreciate that the second law is far more than an explanation of everyday nuisances. It is a foundation of our understanding of the universe and our place in it. In 1928, the physicist Arthur Eddington wrote, The law that entropy always increases holds, I think, the supreme position among the laws of nature. If someone points out to you that your pet theory of the universe is in disagreement with Maxwell's equations, then so much the worse for Maxwell's equations. If it is found to be contradicted by observation, well, these experimentalists do bungle things sometimes. But if your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I can give you no hope. There is nothing for it but to collapse in deepest humiliation. In his famous 1959 Reed Lectures, published as The Two Cultures and the Scientific Revolution, the scientist and novelist C.P. Snow commented on the disdain for science among educated Britons in his day. A good many times I have been present at gatherings of people who, by the standards of the traditional culture, are thought highly educated, and who have with considerable gusto been expressing their incredulity at the illiteracy of scientists. Once or twice I have been provoked, and have asked the company how many of them could describe the second law of thermodynamics. The response was cold. It was also negative. Yet I was asking something which is about the scientific equivalent of, "Have you read a work of Shakespeare's?" The chemist Peter Atkins alludes to the second law in the title of his book, Four Laws That Drive the Universe. And closer to home, the evolutionary psychologists John Tooby, Leda Cosmides, and Clark Barrett entitled a recent paper on the foundations of the science of mind, The Second Law of Thermodynamics is the First Law of Psychology. Why the awe for the second law? From an Olympian vantage point, it defines the fate of the universe and the ultimate purpose of life, mind, and human striving. To deploy energy and knowledge to fight back the tide of entropy and carve out refuges of beneficial order. From a terrestrial vantage point, we can get more specific, but before we get to familiar ground, I need to lay out the other two foundational ideas. At first glance, the law of entropy would seem to allow for only a discouraging history and a depressing future. The universe began in a state of low entropy, the Big Bang, with its unfathomably dense concentration of energy. From there, everything went downhill, with the universe dispersing, as it will continue to do, into a thin gruel of particles evenly and sparsely distributed through space. In reality, of course, the universe as we find it is not a featureless gruel. It is enlivened with galaxies, planets, mountains, clouds, snowflakes, and an efflorescence of flora and fauna, including us. One reason the cosmos is filled with so much interesting stuff is a set of processes called self-organization, which allow circumscribed zones of order to emerge. When energy is poured into a system, and the system dissipates that energy in its slide toward entropy, it can become poised in an orderly, indeed beautiful configuration. A sphere, spiral, starburst, whirlpool, ripple, crystal, or fractal. The fact that we find these configurations beautiful, incidentally, suggests that beauty may not just be in the eye of the beholder. The brain's aesthetic response may be a receptiveness to the counter-entropic patterns that can spring forth from nature. But there is another kind of orderliness in nature that also must be explained. Not the elegant symmetries and rhythms in the physical world, but the functional design in the living world. Living things are made of organs that have heterogeneous parts, which are uncannily shaped and arranged to do things that keep the organism alive. That is, continuing to absorb energy, to resist entropy. The customary illustration of biological design is the eye. But I will make the point with my second favorite sense organ. The human ear contains an elastic drumhead that vibrates in response to the slightest puff of air, a bony lever that multiplies the vibration's force, a piston that impresses the vibration into the fluid in a long tunnel, conveniently coiled to fit inside the wall of the skull, a tapering membrane that runs down the length of the tunnel and physically separates the waveform into its harmonics, and an array of cells with tiny hairs that are flexed back and forth by the vibrating membrane, sending a train of electrical impulses to the brain. It is impossible to explain why these membranes and bones and fluids and hairs are arranged in that improbable way without noting that this configuration allows the brain to register patterned sound. Even the fleshy outer ear, asymmetrical top to bottom and front to back, and crinkled with ridges and valleys, is shaped in a way that sculpts the incoming sound to inform the brain whether the soundmaker is above or below, in front or behind. Organisms are replete with improbable configurations of flesh like eyes, ears, hearts, and stomachs, which cry out for an explanation. Before Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace provided one in 1859, it was reasonable to think they were the handiwork of a divine designer. One of the reasons, I suspect, that so many Enlightenment thinkers were deists rather than outright atheists. Darwin and Wallace made the designer unnecessary. Once self-organizing processes of physics and chemistry gave rise to a configuration of matter that could replicate itself, the copies would make copies, which would make copies of the copies, and so on, in an exponential explosion. The replicating systems would compete for the material to make their copies and the energy to power the replication. Since no copying process is perfect, the law of entropy sees to that, errors will crop up, and though most of these mutations will degrade the replicator, entropy again, occasionally dumb luck will throw one up that's more effective at replicating, and its descendants will swamp the competition. As copying errors that enhance stability and replication accumulate over the generations, the replicating system, we call it an organism, will appear to have been engineered for survival and reproduction in the future, though it only preserved the copying errors that led to survival and reproduction in the past. Creationists commonly doctor the second law of thermodynamics to claim that biological evolution, an increase in order over time, is physically impossible. The part of the law they omit is in a closed system. Organisms are open systems. They capture energy from the sun, food, or ocean vents to carve out temporary pockets of order in their bodies and nests while they dump heat and waste into the environment, increasing disorder in the world as a whole. Organisms' use of energy to maintain their integrity against the press of entropy is a modern explanation of the principle of conatus, effort or striving, which Spinoza defined as the endeavor to persist and flourish in one's own being, and which was a foundation of several Enlightenment-era theories of life and mind. The ironclad requirement to suck energy out of the environment leads to one of the tragedies of living things. While plants bask in solar energy, and a few creatures of the briny deep soak up the chemical broth spewing from cracks in the ocean floor, animals are born exploiters. They live off the hard-won energy stored in the bodies of plants and other animals by eating them. So do the viruses, bacteria, and other pathogens and parasites that gnaw at bodies from the inside. With the exception of fruit, everything we call food is the body part or energy store of some other organism, which would just as soon keep that treasure for itself. Nature is a war, and much of what captures our attention in the natural world is an arms race. Prey animals protect themselves with shells, spines, claws, horns, venom, camouflage, flight, or self-defense. Plants have thorns, rinds, bark, and irritants and poisons saturating their tissues. Animals evolve weapons to penetrate these defenses. Carnivores have speed, talons, and eagle-eyed vision, while herbivores have grinding teeth and livers that detoxify natural poisons. And now we come to the third keystone, information. Information may be thought of as a reduction in entropy, as the ingredient that distinguishes an orderly, structured system from the vast set of random, useless ones. Imagine pages of random characters tapped out by a monkey at a typewriter, or a stretch of white noise from a radio tuned between channels, or a screen full of confetti from a corrupted computer file. Each of these objects can take trillions of different forms, each as boring as the next. But now suppose that the devices are controlled by a signal that arranges the characters or sound waves or pixels into a pattern that correlates with something in the world. The Declaration of Independence, the opening bars of Hey Jude, a cat wearing sunglasses. We say that the signal transmits information about the declaration or the song or the cat. The information contained in a pattern depends on how coarsely or finely grained our view of the world is. If we cared about the exact sequence of characters in the monkey's output, or the precise difference between one burst of noise and another, or the particular pattern of pixels in just one of the haphazard displays, then we would have to say that each of the items contains the same amount of information as the others. Indeed, the interesting ones would contain less information, because when you look at one part, like the letter Q, you can guess others, such as the following letter U, without needing the signal. But more commonly, we lump together the immense majority of random-looking configurations as equivalently boring, and distinguish them all from the tiny few that correlate with something else. From that vantage point, the cat photo contains more information than the confetti of pixels, because it takes a garrulous message to pinpoint a rare orderly configuration out of the vast number of equivalently disorderly ones. To say that the universe is orderly rather than random is to say that it contains information in this sense. Some physicists enshrine information as one of the basic constituents of the universe, together with matter and energy. Information is what gets accumulated in a genome in the course of evolution. The sequence of bases in a DNA molecule correlates with the sequence of amino acids in the proteins that make up the organism's body. And they got that sequence by structuring the organism's ancestors, reducing their entropy, into the improbable configurations that allowed them to capture energy and grow and reproduce. Information is also collected by an animal's nervous system as it lives its life. When the ear transduces sound into neural firings, the two physical processes, vibrating air and diffusing ions, could not be more different. But thanks to the correlation between them, the pattern of neural activity in the animal's brain carries information about the sound in the world. From there, the information can switch from electrical to chemical and back as it crosses the synapses connecting one neuron to the next. Through all these physical transformations, the information is preserved. A momentous discovery of 20th century theoretical neuroscience is that networks of neurons not only can preserve information, but can transform it in ways that allow us to explain how brains can be intelligent. Two input neurons can be connected to an output neuron in such a way that their firing patterns correspond to logical relations such as and, or, and not, or to a statistical decision that depends on the weight of the incoming evidence. That gives neural networks the power to engage in information processing or computation. Given a large enough network built out of these logical and statistical circuits, and with billions of neurons the brain has room for plenty, a brain can compute complex functions, the prerequisite for intelligence. It can transform the information about the world that it receives from the sense organs in a way that mirrors the laws governing that world, which in turn allows it to make useful inferences and predictions. Internal representations that reliably correlate with states of the world and that participate in inferences that tend to derive true implications from true premises may be called knowledge. We say that someone knows what a robin is if she thinks the thought robin whenever she sees one, and if she can infer that it is a kind of bird which appears in the spring and pulls worms out of the ground. Getting back to evolution, a brain wired by information in the genome to perform computations on information coming in from the senses could organize the animal's behavior in a way that allowed it to capture energy and resist entropy. It could, for example, implement the rule, if it squeaks, chase it, if it barks, flee from it. Chasing and fleeing, though, are not just sequences of muscle contractions, they are goal-directed. Chasing may consist of running, or climbing, or leaping, or ambushing, depending on the circumstances, as long as it increases the chances of snagging the prey. Fleeing may include hiding or freezing or zigzagging. And that brings up another momentous 20th century idea, sometimes called cybernetics, feedback, or control. The idea explains how a physical system can appear to be teleological, that is, directed by purposes or goals. All it needs are a way of sensing the state of itself and its environment, a representation of a goal state, what it wants, what it's trying for, an ability to compute the difference between the current state and the goal state, and a repertoire of actions that are tagged with their typical effects. If the system is wired so that it triggers actions that typically reduce the difference between the current state and the goal state, it can be said to pursue goals, and when the world is sufficiently predictable, it will attain them. The principle was discovered by natural selection in the form of homeostasis, as when our bodies regulate their temperature by shivering and sweating. When it was discovered by humans, it was engineered into analog systems like thermostats and cruise control, and then into digital systems like chess-playing programs and autonomous robots. The principles of information, computation, and control bridge the chasm between the physical world of cause and effect and the mental world of knowledge, intelligence, and purpose. It's not just a rhetorical aspiration to say that ideas can change the world. It's a fact about the physical makeup of brains. The Enlightenment thinkers had an inkling that thought could consist of patterns in matter. They likened ideas to impressions in wax, vibrations in a string, or waves from a boat. And some, like Hobbes, proposed that reasoning is but reckoning, in the original sense of reckoning as calculation. But before the concepts of information and computation were elucidated, it was reasonable for someone to be a mind-body dualist and attribute mental life to an immaterial soul. Just as before the concept of evolution was elucidated, it was reasonable to be a creationist and attribute design in nature to a cosmic designer. That's another reason, I suspect, that so many Enlightenment thinkers were deists. Of course, it's natural to think twice about whether your cell phone truly knows a favorite number, your GPS is really figuring out the best route home, and your Roomba is genuinely trying to clean the floor. But as information processing systems become more sophisticated, as their representations of the world become richer, their goals are arranged into hierarchies of sub-goals within sub-goals, and their actions for attaining the goals become more diverse and less predictable. It starts to look like hominid chauvinism to insist that they don't. Whether information and computation explain consciousness in addition to knowledge, intelligence, and purpose is a question I'll turn to in the final chapter. Human intelligence remains the benchmark for the artificial kind, and what makes Homo sapiens an unusual species is that our ancestors invested in bigger brains that collected more information about the world, reasoned about it in more sophisticated ways, and deployed a greater variety of actions to achieve their goals. They specialized in the cognitive niche, also called the cultural niche, and the hunter-gatherer niche. This embraced a suite of new adaptations, including the ability to manipulate mental models of the world and predict what would happen if one tried out new things. The ability to cooperate with others, which allowed teams of people to accomplish what a single person could not, and language, which allowed them to coordinate their actions and to pool the fruits of their experience into the collections of skills and norms we call cultures. These investments allowed early hominids to defeat the defenses of a wide range of plants and animals and reap the bounty in energy, which stoked their expanding brains, giving them still more know-how and access to still more energy. A well-studied contemporary hunter-gatherer tribe, the Hadza of Tanzania, who live in the ecosystem where modern humans first evolved and probably preserve much of their lifestyle, extract 3,000 calories daily per person from more than 880 species. They create this menu through ingenious and uniquely human ways of foraging, such as felling large animals with poison-tipped arrows, smoking bees out of their hives to steal their honey, and enhancing the nutritional value of meat and tubers by cooking them. Energy channeled by knowledge is the elixir with which we stave off entropy, and advances in energy capture are advances in